Okay, now I wish to again present the famous Ken Carty.
Well, thank you. I take it that you weren't hopelessly displeased you were going to hear from me again this morning. I did appreciate all the comments we got yesterday, both the positive and helpful, because it is a kind of challenge to know what we can do that will be helpful for you. I mean, our job is not to try and tell you about these systems in a way that kind of says this is what you ought to do, but really to kind of raise some questions. And so I hope I planted some questions in some minds yesterday. A couple of people have asked about the PowerPoint presentation and whether it can be made available, and we can certainly put it on the web, and we'll do that if that will be helpful. Once we get into a kind of pattern when it's where it's fairly clear what's working and what's not working, we'll try and put these PowerPoint presentations on the web a few days in advance so people could download them and then play with them or decide whether that was a session they wanted to come to. No, I didn't mean that. Well, we want to talk about assessing electoral systems this morning. And in some sense, we're going to touch on some of the questions we had talked about before. I'm going to do it a little bit differently this morning, or at least I'm going to use the PowerPoint in just a little bit of a different way. We're going to talk about 9 different criteria in which we assess electoral systems. And I thought, just so you'd have some questions to think about, I'd mostly put questions up on the screen. I know some people got the odd question out of what we talked about yesterday, but I thought if we put up 3 or 4 questions for 9 different topics, that'd be a few questions to think about. Because these are the questions you're going to really need to be asking yourself as we start looking at the individual families of systems in some detail. So the PowerPoint presentation is really not kind of following the script in quite the same way we did yesterday, but throwing up questions on each of those topics as a way of perhaps something to think about. And hopefully you can let me know if that kind of works for you. You'll get a chance on the evaluation forms at the end of the discussion group periods. While I'm on the evaluation forms, let me just say we appreciate all the people who did complete our foundation survey. One of the big challenges, and we've talked about this, I know, informally several times, is to tell the story of the assembly and how did it work as a huge democratic experiment. Because if it works, other people are going to try it. In fact, Ontario government's already thinking very seriously about it. We know the Yukon government will be thinking seriously about it for questions about electoral systems, but about questions about other kinds of public policy areas. And so one of the things we're going to want to do in an important way at the end of this process is write an account, perhaps a book, about how the assembly worked. And having these kind of surveys, which allows the members to speak, is extremely helpful. And I think almost everyone filled it out, and we're very appreciative of it. There were a few people who either didn't get it in yet, or perhaps it's in the mail. Maybe they lost their form. I think there's about 12 people. And if they've lost their form and want another one, it's not too late. And I'd be happy to give you one. Okay, well, we want to talk about choosing among electoral systems and the kind of criteria we would use to try and do that. And to choose among electoral systems, and I think we tried to suggest this yesterday, involves deciding about what kind of politics we want and then trying to think about, well, what kind of electoral system would give it to us. So yesterday we tried to talk about what kind of politics we wanted, to try to identify some of the criteria that were important to us as voters about the political world. About the political world that we have here in British Columbia. What are the things that were good and what are the things that are challenging? Well, in this session, I want to try and, in some sense, reverse that and focus not on where we're standing, but looking at the electoral system half of that equation and identify some of the criteria that are normally used to grade electoral systems. And anything you'll read, we'll talk about these criteria and apply them to individual systems. In David Farrell's textbook, a blue book, cunningly the same color as the learning binder, you'll see in chapter 7, here's something you might be interested in reading over the next couple of weeks, he talks about criteria for assessing electoral systems. He also talks about it in chapter 9, because he talks about some of the systems and then talks about the criteria. We'll be coming back to do some of that as well. But David talks about the direct effects that electoral systems have. We want to compare systems in terms of direct effects, how it directly changes the proportionality of a system, how it directly can affect the number of political parties that will really be there, how it will directly affect the proportions of traditionally disadvantaged groups getting elected. He also talks about more indirect effects. He calls them systemic effects. The consequences of some of these first things. So electoral systems can make a political system more proportional, but what are the consequences of that? So it's a kind of second-order effect. And how does that flow through? He talks about strategic effects because electoral systems are the rules of the game by which the politicians play and the parties play. So if you change the rules of the game, they're going to change their strategies. You know, when the Montreal Canadiens were so wonderful and so great all through the 50s, at that time in the National Hockey League, if a team scored a goal when they had an odd man advantage, the other team's man didn't come back on the ice. It was a two-minute penalty, and you're out for the 2 minutes. Well, the Montreal Canadiens were so fabulous that they would score two and three times when another team would have a penalty. And the league said, well, how can we cut these guys down to size? We can't be as good as they are. So let's change the rule. And as soon as a team scores in a penalty, then the guy can come back on. But as soon as you change that rule, then the whole kind of strategy of playing the penalty part of the game changed. So you change the rules, you change the kinds of strategies. So what are some of those kinds of effects, and how do they work? And David also talks about party effects. So you'll see that there's a kind of way of you can categorize different kinds of effects. The Law Commission of Canada is going to come out in the next month or so with a big proposal for reforming the Canadian electoral system for national electoral politics, been done by that commission in Ottawa. And they're going to have a set of criteria, four or five, I think, on which they assess electoral systems. A number of political scientists have written books, and they all have different kinds of categories, but they all tend in one way or another to address some of the same kind of issues. Well, this morning I want to identify some of the kind of questions we're going to be asking and talk about those questions and what they're about and why we want to ask them about electoral systems so that when we actually come to do that, we'll kind of know what we're doing it for and how they can compare. And then just say at the end a little bit about the kind of trade-offs amongst these criteria. And a number of these will come back in some sense, and you'll see how they touch on the values that we talked about yesterday, that they are connected. And if we know what those values are, then we can know what we want to bring to those assessments. So we want to talk about electoral systems in terms of the kind of impact that they have on the system of government and the way the government works. And there are four or five criteria that virtually all attempts to compare and assess electoral systems focus on. And the first one is the question of stable government. How does an electoral system contribute to stable government or effective government? There are questions about how does the electoral system directly impinge on electoral accountability? It's not the only thing that impinges on it, but it will make a difference. And how does it make a difference? How does the electoral system affect the capacity of Parliament to check the government? We talked about some of these things yesterday. How does the electoral system work on affecting the extent and degree and kind of representation there is for parties and groups? How does the electoral system have some kind of impact on political parties? Well, some of those things we talked about in value terms, in terms of do they matter to us? We have to know whether they matter to us in terms before we can decide how important we want to rank those criteria. Well, electoral systems have some impact on government and how it works. But, of course, electoral systems also have some impact on us as individual voters. And we want to think about the electoral system not only from the perspective of the system, but we need to think about it from the perspective of us as voters, as citizens. Does it give us the kind of choice we want? Does it give us the kind of representatives do we want? Do they encourage us to participate? What kind of equality does it provide for? And virtually all electoral systems do more or less of these things, and they do them in different ways with different kinds of consequences. And those are, and these kind of nine things, these kind of five dimensions we talked about on, or I just referred to in system of government, these four about the effect on individual voters, are the kind of things that we will essentially be measuring different electoral systems on as a way of kind of trying to come to grips with what they're about and how they work. So I want to talk a little bit this morning about each of those to try and say, well, what these criteria are, what they mean, and how we might think about them and why we might bother to think about them. Well, the first one was stable and effective government. Well, I suppose you could say the argument for having a stable government is sort of obvious. Stable government is probably a good thing. Stable governments can make hard decisions. You know, governments often have to do things that are unpopular or difficult. And if you have a government that isn't very stable, it's going to just find it very difficult to do that, might not be able to do that. Governments sometimes need to be able to move quickly. And if you don't have a well-established, stable, effective government, it can't respond to national crises, to international crises, to radically changing circumstances, economic or social. If you don't have a stable government, how can it plan? And very often, of course, if we want to change things or we want to alter some pattern, you know, you need to think about it, you need to research it, you need to prepare a legislation, then you need to pass it, then you need to implement it, and then you need to budget for it. And these things take 2 and 3 years' time. You don't change hospital systems or transportation systems overnight. But if you have a government that's likely to change next month, it's very difficult for those kinds of governments to engage in the kind of systematic planning or organization that's necessary. So that would seem to be another argument why you would care about stable government. One might want a stable government because you think, in fact, you don't want a government that constantly has to be out there bargaining with some other groups to ensure that it's going to be in office next week. If you have a government that's constantly having to look over its shoulder and make deals with other kinds of groups, perhaps in parliament, that's not going to be a particularly effective or a stable kind of pattern. And stable governments, I suppose, are the kinds of governments that are not likely to be defeated on the whim of a few politicians. You know, do we really want half a dozen disaffected MLAs to come into parliament tomorrow and defeat the government because it didn't do something for their riding, or they're unhappy, or they were left out of the cabinet, or the dozens of kinds of reasons you might think about. So it may well be that there's another kind of reason for stable government. And we know that in situations of instability, you can get cycles of uncertainty and confusion. Governments that don't survive long are often defeated by rather arbitrary action by politicians, by parliamentarians. And there's lots of examples in other kinds of systems where governments are engaged in some kind of systematic planning exercise and suddenly get thrown out for reasons completely unconnected with that, and then big periods of uncertainty. And very often thrown out by people who aren't going to have to then take responsibility by forming the government themselves. They just didn't like the government, so they defeat it and say, well, do something different, do something better, but yet they themselves are not in a position to do anything about it. So that might well be a problem. In unstable systems, people would sometimes argue that indecisive elections are often held too often. And some people would argue that too frequent elections is not a very productive kind of way of doing business. And certainly indecisive elections aren't particularly useful. And of course, in unstable situations, governments just shy away from making hard decisions, a kind of version of what we talked about, and don't make coherent public policy. But the whole question of government stability is a bit misleading. And there's lots of ways to think about it. And, you know, when we read about the government stability, one of the ways it's often measured is how long did the government survive. If governments survive on average less than a year, that's often seen as unstable. We all know about the Italian case, you know. Or if we haven't, we're going to know about it, because it's always thrown up as the bad example. The Italians have had more governments since the Second World War than there's been years. And the governments last less than a year, and then they get defeated, another government gets formed, and they start all over again. We know that the Japanese have had more prime ministers since the end of the Second World War than Canada's had in its entire history. You know, they last a kind of year and a half, and then a prime minister gets defeated, and they get another one. So we would think, well, those must be hopeless places. But we know that Italy isn't hopeless. We know that Japan isn't hopeless. And they've had lots of success and lots of difficulties in all those processes. So, and we also know that, in fact, the Italians had this endless revolving door sets of governments, but the same party was in power most of the time, with the Liberal Democrats, the Christian Democrats. And they had kind of different partners, and they kind of moved around. But there was this kind of apparently constant revolving door system. The Japanese had these endless procession of prime ministers, all elderly gentlemen of no doubt at merit. But they were all basically from the same political party. They were all Liberal Democrats. So, like, was that system so more unstable? In some sense, that those kind of revolving door governments were kind of like cabinet shuffles in this country. You know, the prime minister shuffles their cabinets every year or two. We don't think, well, that's hopelessly unstable because the same guy's at the top. Or for a few months, the same woman was at the top. And so maybe in some sense, you know, the Italians and the Japanese, by changing the prime ministers and changing the governments, but not really changing maybe the basic underlying system, had just a different version, a different way of doing it. So we need to be careful about thinking about government instability and what it really looks like and what the process is about. And, of course, we also know there's a dark side to all this, and we alluded to that yesterday, because governments that last for a long time and don't look like they can get defeated can get insensitive and arrogant. They often become unwilling to compromise. And sometimes they're too easily dominated by dictatorial leaders. Well, we know that electoral systems can make a profound difference to government stability by exaggerating their support in a legislature, by giving them guaranteed long lives. And so a big question for us is, how important is the trade-off between so-called government stability, capacity of a government to kind of know that it's going to be there next year, and the other features of a political life that we think are important. David Farrell actually has a couple of interesting tables. I think you'll find them in Chapter 9 somewhere when you come to read it later on, in which he actually gives you the kind of length of time governments last in different systems and in different countries. You'll see that governments last relatively long in Canada. We've had in democratic systems, amongst the longest-lasting governments of almost any country. There's 28 or 30, I think, countries in that table. I think it's table 9.1, the first table in chapter 9. You'll find it there. And he discusses what some of this stuff means. And I think we're fifth or sixth at the top in terms of the longevity. Well, you'll see when you read about it that a lot of that has to do with the kind of electoral system we have, not maybe particularly the merits of our kinds of government. So government stability, the length of government, how long they do, is an important set of questions to ask about and think about, and how much we care about that, because that's an important consideration in a lot of the debates about electoral stability. We always hear about the pizza parliaments of Italy or whatever. But kind of what does that mean? We need to ask ourselves. Okay, well, so some of these are the kind of questions we're going to be thinking about. Electoral accountability. There's lots of questions we could think about that, but we know that elections allow us to choose representatives. Some electoral systems also allow us to be involved in a more direct way in choosing governments. But for elections to be about the choice of governments and not just of representatives, it's necessary that voters can identify the parties that are responsible, that were responsible for government in the past, and that political parties and candidates can clearly signal what they intend to do if they get elected. Because if there are more than two parties, and if no party is going to win a majority, voters may well want to know, well, which parties will get together? What are the possible coalitions out there? Because if they don't know that, they're not going to be able to have much influence in shaping the kind of government. In British Columbia, it's pretty clear. We have a kind of system that makes elections very much a choice of governments. We saw how that worked in the last couple of elections. If you wanted a particular government, you voted one way. If you wanted to get rid of one, it was pretty clear how to do that. But electoral systems, of course, that produce parliaments with no obvious or predictable majority very often can produce situations in which it's not the election that will choose the government, but the particular collection of politicians who are elected to the parliament that will get together and make some kind of bargains after the elections. And in those situations, parties may have to compromise their principles that won them votes in order to kind of win them a coalition partner. Parties may say, well, we stand for this. This is the most important thing. But they don't have a majority, and if they want to be in office, they're going to have some other partners. And all the other partners will say, well, we'll take you, but we're not taking you if you insist on that, that you claim that it was the most important thing when you won your vote. So do you sacrifice that and go into the government? Because you do stand for a lot of other good things. Or do you say, no, we won't go in, and we'll simply stay out. Sometimes political parties can make coalition bargains before the election. So people know, well, if I vote for this party, I'm really voting for this collection of parties. But that's not always clear. We'll learn about situations in which, after changes, voters thought they were voting for one thing, ended up getting something quite different because the parties suddenly discovered they were in a different situation after the election and had to then decide if they were going to compromise or make different kinds of bargains. It's often true that in these kinds of systems, governments can take quite a long time to form after an election. The Dutch regularly used to take 2 or 3 months after an election to decide who would actually have won the election and what the government would look like. Doesn't need to be, but certain kind of electoral systems will produce those kind of situations. The Dutch system was one of very high proportionality. Lots of parties got elected. There might be 8 or 9 in the parliament, and it would take them 3 or 4 months after the election to kind of figure out what particular combination was going to come together. Once they did, they were usually very stable and persistent and were successful. But it really meant that was the election choosing exercise. That was the government choosing exercise, and it wasn't really the election. So electoral systems can facilitate different kinds of electoral accountability amongst the parties. We know that it's clearest when single parties governments are there, but accountability can work in different kinds of ways in other sorts of systems. And we'll see that in various proportional systems, accountability can work very differently and does. And how we think about that and whether we think that's clear is important. But there's another side to accountability, too, and that's the kind of personal accountability for individual representatives. Under our system, of course, if you don't like your MLA, you can get rid of them. It's pretty easy. You vote against them. And if enough people agree with you, he or she is gone. Electoral systems that are based more on political parties rather than individual candidates make it much more difficult to exercise that kind of personal accountability. If you have a system in which the party just produces a list of candidates, and if they win 10 seats, they just get the first 10 names off that list, mean that voters don't have very much of a way of getting rid of any of those people who are in the top 10. They have kind of guaranteed seats. People at the bottom, you don't have much way of getting them in. So the kind of personal accountability as opposed to the governmental accountability can be quite different. So the question has to be asked, what kind of accountability does a particular system give us, and how does it do that? How does it work? And how do we compare systems in terms of the different kinds of accountabilities that they generate for us as voters and for us as an electorate, a collection of voters, a community of citizens? Okay, the third set of criteria that we're going to find a lot of literature about, and it's going to constantly come up, is this business that we alluded to yesterday about whether Parliament can really scrutinize the role of the government. Can the elected representatives effectively have an impact on the government? We know that legislatures in Canada are pretty bad at this. You know, the current Prime Minister of Canada ran his leadership campaign mostly on the claim that there was a major democratic deficit in Canada. He went around the country for the last year and a half saying, there's a huge democratic deficit in Canada, it's got to be fixed. And what he meant was that Parliament didn't work anymore. Now, he thinks he can fix Canadian democracy by making Parliament more effective, to returning to a more traditional way of members of Parliament having a greater role and greater say, and he's got a number of different ideas about how that might work. So there's a kind of widespread recognition that in our system, this is one of the great failings of the system. Parliaments can do some of that themselves. Political parties can do some of that as the government is engaged in trying to do. And there's been already, some of us have been watching in Ottawa. He's had the caucus having much more say, apparently, in what the throne speech is going to say. Members are going to have more say in government decision-making, we're told. More free votes. Well, that will certainly change it, and that can all happen without changing the electoral system. But there are also things one could do with different electoral systems that would alter party discipline so that maybe these things wouldn't have to be done, that members would just simply be freed up. But we know that in other kinds of electoral systems, leaders have even more power than ours do. Because they can list all the candidates in their party and pretty well determine who's going to get elected and who's not going to get elected by controlling party lists. And so the kind of electoral system could have a direct impact on the kinds of people who get in, what their obligations are to the leader, how much they owe to the leader, what kind of freedoms they can have. And even in systems where there are nominally free votes, if the leader really determines whether you have any chance of getting nominated and any chance of getting elected next time, you can have a kind of free vote, but if you don't vote freely the way your leader wants, you may find yourself pushed down on the list. We've seen that in the European Parliament uses a list system in Britain. And a number of the members elected in the Labour Party to the European Parliament were not voting the way that the leader of the Liberal Party was really happy about. They found the next election, their names got pushed farther down the list. And the farther down the list they went, the less chance they had of getting elected. And so they weren't so likely to want to be free spirits. Well, they had to choose between being a free spirit and actually being an elected person. And I guess you want to be a free spirit only if you are elected. So systems will work in different kinds of ways around these kinds of questions. Systems that don't give governments artificial majorities can strengthen the hand of the legislature by making the government more dependent on it for its existence and making the leadership maybe more responsive. We know that parliamentary checks on government are likely to be found in legislatures with more than two or three political parties, where there are more parties, where governments don't have easy control of a majority. But it may well be that those are the systems that are least likely to give you stable government. So if you're assessing an electoral system in terms of stable government, you might get one set of scores. You begin to think, well, okay, now let's assess it in terms of account of parliamentary check on government, you're going to get a very different kind of scores. Well, how do you combine those scores? Partly the way you combine them depends on which do you think are most important and how you prioritize them. Is it possible for an electoral system to combine the two in some kind of way? What kind of balances? Will some electoral systems give us a bit of this and a bit of that? And in what way? And how could they do that? And would that work for us? So those are questions that when we look at proportional systems or list systems or transferable vote systems or majority systems or the kind of plurality system we have, these are all terms we'll come back to, and not to worry. That's a big question to ask. Well, fair representation, we talked a little bit about this yesterday, but you'll see that this is one of the biggies. This is one of the biggest questions there is. In assessments of electoral systems, how fair is it? And there's a number of different issues to this about whether votes are counted equally. Are some votes wasted? Do parties win their fair share? Is there some kind of equal representation? And different electoral systems answer those questions differently. And they answer them in different ways, and those different ways have then different consequences, these strategic consequences, you know. They change the rules, and so maybe people play the penalty game differently. To go back to the hockey analogy. Equal votes. Well, it seems intuitive, I guess, that all votes ought to count equally in a democracy. Surely we have, in some sense, a basic conviction that all votes ought to count equally. Somehow that seems to mean for us what democracy is about. Not only that we have a vote, but they ought all to be equal. Rich people's votes shouldn't count more than poor people's, or better educated people's votes shouldn't count less than less well-educated people's, or people who live in one area's vote shouldn't count more than people who live in another area's. If you have a system that has constituencies, you have to find a way to provide for equal voting. And that's been a great dilemma for us in our kinds of system. And one of the ways we do it is constantly change the electoral boundaries. I mean, if the population didn't change and nobody moved, it wouldn't be a problem. You know, but one voter in, I think, 5 moves in Canada every year. We've got one of the most mobile populations in the world, constantly changing, constantly growing. And this means that providing equality for those people, if we can find them where they are on any given week, is a real challenge. In the last BC election, let me tell you, about 9,000 people voted in Peace River North District to elect their member of the legislature. Over 27,000 people voted in the Comox Valley. So I guess simple arithmetic would suggest if 9,000 people voted for one member here, and, you know, across the province, 27,000 voted for another member there, the votes in the Comox Valley were worth only one-third of what they were in Peace River North. Or the Peace River North people's votes were worth 3 times as much as those in Comox Valley. It's one way of thinking about it. Well, maybe that's reasonable. Maybe the people in Peace River North are 3 times as smart or 3 times as deserving or 3 times as meritorious as the people in the Comox Valley. I don't know, and if I did, I certainly wouldn't say in public. But we want to ask what kind of electoral system does that sort of thing. And if we're going to provide for equal voting power, how do we deal with that kind of problem? Our traditional way, as I say, has been to constantly change the electoral boundaries to try and keep up with this kind of movement. Growth of population in some areas, shift declines in others, people moving. But, of course, as soon as we do that, you know, we're abandoning the kind of logic that suggests that it's kind of different communities have different interests and therefore they need to be represented. You know, the Peace River North is a kind of identifiable area. The Comox Valley is an identifiable area. And maybe each of those areas somehow should have their voice in the legislature. But if one has 3 times as many people, it's complicated. Maybe we should just have 3 members from the Comox Valley and 1 member from Peace River North, and that would kind of equalize it out. But then that would be a different kind of electoral system. We've had a version of that, of course, in the past when we used to have the multi-member districts. Wasted votes. Now, here's a kind of really tricky kind of question. It's a controversial term. I think most people, when they talk about wasted votes, they mean votes that people cast but don't actually contribute to electing anybody. Some people think that if an MLA gets 40% of the vote and wins, then the 60% of the people who voted for somebody else somehow wasted their vote. Well, it's a kind of odd notion. It's a kind of a notion that if you have a race and the people who lose, they kind of wasted their time sort of by racing. It's not a perfect analogy, but it's something like that. But we know that there are lots of people who vote for parties or for candidates that are unsuccessful. In the last election, Elections BC website tells me that 197,231 British Columbians voted for the Green Party. Not a single member of that party got elected. Now, did that 197,231 people waste their vote, or did they simply lose? Different people provide with different answers and different understandings of that kind of question. You see, it's possible to imagine a system in which those 197,231 people, seeing that they couldn't possibly, under our system, elect their candidate, we could have asked them, well, okay, your first choice doesn't get in. Well, who's your second choice? You know, so let's let you have some say in terms of your vote kind of counting towards electing somebody. You can't get who your first choice is because there's not enough of you or no one else wants them. But, you know, we just don't want to throw you on the scrap heap and say, you lose. We want to say, well, okay, you know, what's your second choice? And so there are electoral systems that could do that. And some people would say, well, that's a way of not wasting those people's votes. That's a way of allowing them to contribute. And then preferential voting, that is where you put your preferences in order, 1, 2, 3, is a kind of solution to that sort of system. So are wasted votes an issue we need to think about? And if so, how might we assess electoral systems' ability to deal with that? As we'll see next week, by the way, we did that in British Columbia 2 times. In the 1950s, we had a kind of preferential system. Gave us social credit for almost half a century. Again, I'm not going to say whether I think that was a good or a bad idea. Proportionality, this is the kind of the fair share stuff we talked a little bit about yesterday. And inevitably, we have to come to grips with assessing how proportional systems are. Because one of the biggest criticisms of the system is that they don't provide fair shares, that the shares of votes don't equal the share of the seats. And we saw this extraordinarily dramatically in the last British Columbia election, but we could see it in virtually every British Columbia election in our history. Parties get way more votes than they get seats, or way fewer votes than they get seats, so there's no connection. And it's certainly possible to have systems that are almost purely proportional, or partly proportional, or mixed proportional, or supplementary proportional. There's a range of things. And how proportional and what kind of proportionality is one of the key things that differentiates electoral systems. As I said, we can't go to a proportional system unless we have some people elected from other than single-member districts. But there could be some, I suppose, some kind of combination. And if we go to a more proportional system, are we likely to go to multi-party politics, the number of parties? Almost certainly. And will that likely lead to coalition government? Well, it does in most places. So how important is proportionality, and how much? These are the big questions. You'll see again in David Farrell, I think, in the first table in Chapter 7 and some of the other tables in Chapter 7, just how many parties different kinds of systems produce, how proportional they are. And there are measures, and there are lots of measures of proportionality. Sometimes it's called disproportionality, because academics like to make up longer words and complicated measures. But he has a nice set of scales, and high numbers means that there's not much connection, and low numbers mean they're pretty comparable. And you can see, and you'll see that Canada has a kind of system that doesn't produce very proportional results compared to other systems, but there's an enormous variation. And different systems can produce as much or as little proportionality as you want, and proportionality for some parties but not other parties. And so these are very big questions. You know, Premier Lord a week or two ago in New Brunswick announced a commission on legislative democracy. We're very fortunate the research director for that commission, Dr. Cross, is here visiting and observing the assembly this weekend. But one of the things that commission was told to do was to produce a recommendation that would have a more proportional system. They're very clear they want more proportionality. You know, I don't think they know kind of how much they want or how they will get it. That's what this commission that they have set up is going to investigate for them. But it's always going to be one of the big items. How important is that, and what does more proportionality look like? And finally, representation of excluded groups. You know, politics in most democratic systems has traditionally been dominated by a kind of predictable sort of person. We know what they're like. They're overeducated. They're middle-aged. They're middle class. They're males from the dominant cultural community. You know, people like Jack Blaney or Ken Carty. You know, let's be honest about this, eh? And for the most part, of course, parties have thrown up those sorts of people. But there's now a lot of evidence to suggest that different electoral systems will throw up very different kinds of people in different measures. You know, we know, let's take the question of the representation of women, and I raise it because in a very bold move when the British Columbia government set up this assembly, it said it ought to have equal numbers of men and women. The only assembly I know of ever been created in the world in which that kind of commitment was made. We wanted to hear those kind of voices. And we know, and Farrell has some interesting statistics in one of his tables in Chapter 7, tables 7.1 and 7.4. I mentioned that just so you'll know I've looked at them. That show that different kinds of systems systematically alter, say, the proportion of women in parliaments. Now, if there was just a few more in Burundi this week and a few less in Brazil or some more in Belgium or low in Scandinavia, you say, well, that's one thing. But if you can say that year after year, decade after decade, the relationship is systematically related to the electoral system, then you know that by choosing a particular kind of electoral system, you're going to systematically increase or decrease the proportion of women in legislatures, or visible minorities, or Aboriginal peoples, or depending on the groups in different kind of societies. Well, we know the kind of society we have, and we know the kind of legislature we have, and so we want to think about, in assessing an electoral system, how is it going to affect that? How is it going to affect the kind of people that are in this legislature? Because by choosing, we will be deciding that. Not quite clear how some of these kind of things happen, and we'll talk about that, the mechanism. But the fact that there's a kind of systematic difference suggests that there is an effect that's being driven in some way by the electoral system. Electoral systems do make some kind of a difference, so if we care about that, we need to think about it. So the question is, are there groups in British Columbia that aren't elected to the legislature? Should this be a consideration? Well, it needs to be a consideration because it's a fact, and if we don't consider it, we'll be, in effect, deciding by default. So we want to have this as one of our assessment criteria. Political parties, I think, was the fifth of the kind of system effects that we need to think about, and we're going to use as a kind of criteria. We're going to talk about political parties in a bit more detail next week because we can't talk about elections without talking about political parties. For some people, political parties are part of the problem, and particularly party discipline is part of the problem. Yet without political parties, most people think we probably can't have a true democracy. People think that because we don't know of any working democracies that don't have political parties to recruit candidates, to offer coordinated sets of policies to the voters, to provide an instrument by which there's a kind of collective dimension to the electoral process. Maybe an assembly could invent such a process. It hasn't been in other places. There is a submission on the website that Campbell talked about earlier called None of the Above. And it's a kind of worked out scheme about how at the bottom of every ballot should be a none of the above. And basically it's a system to have no political parties. And so, you know, we may want to think about that too. But it's political parties that give us a kind of a collective dimension. Because when people in the Bulkley Valley vote in an election for a candidate, and people in Vancouver Point Grey, where I happen to live, vote for a candidate, one of the things that allows them to be engaged in the same process, in making the same choice, is that the political parties are connecting up. Because if people in the Bulkley Valley are voting for Party A, they're making a kind of statement. And if I in Vancouver, Point Grey, am also voting for Party A, we're engaged in a kind of collective decision-making that wouldn't be possible. They just had a list of A, you know, John, Mary, and Bill, and I had a list of Sally, Mike, and Joan. There wouldn't be anything connecting us. We wouldn't be engaged in a similar process. We'd just be engaged in choosing random individual members. The fact that there's a kind of party dimension to it brings us together in a more kind of collective decision-making exercise. Well, electoral systems can shape political parties in a lot of different and important ways. They can have a profound impact on power relationships in political parties, determining how candidates are selected. What's the role of the citizens in this, and how can citizens have some kind of impact? They can have more or less say about the kinds of candidates that parties are likely to put forward. One of the reasons some systems probably elect more women is because the parties find reasons to nominate more women, because the electoral system produces a set of incentives that changes the way the parties will operate. We know that electoral systems will influence the number of parties that exist, that are regular participants in the process, and the kind of varied parties that there are. And you'll see again in David Farrell, I think, in some interesting tables, again in Chapter 7, just simply that there are systematically regular differences in the number of political parties contesting elections and being present in Parliament, depending on the kind of electoral system you have. Our kind of electoral system discourages political parties, rewards only two or three of them and shuts large numbers out. And when people are shut out, they think, well, maybe then I've got to kind of go and join another party. That's, of course, the dilemma that the Conservatives and the Alliance Party have been faced with in this country. If they want to be serious players, they have to quit being two separate parties and become one. Shrinks the number of political parties. If we had a proportional representation system, they wouldn't be forced to join together. They could come with their separate programs and come into Parliament, then cooperate or not on different issues in Parliament, but they wouldn't be forced into this kind of system. So some systems forces a kind of great vote vacuuming catch-all kinds of political party organizations. Other systems facilitate the proliferation of more varied kinds of parties, perhaps more ideological parties, more programmatic parties, rather than our kind of catch-all parties. And, of course, different electoral systems structures the competition amongst these parties. You know, some systems facilitate lots of parties, and other systems discourage lots of parties and try and force people into two or three camps, then the kind of competition that's likely to exist will be different. You know, a two-person game is very different than a six-person game, right? The dynamics are more complicated. You know, if you have one brother, that's one thing. If you have six sisters, you know, it's another whole world, right? Well, it's not so different. That different kinds of games are played in different kinds of ways. So given the centrality of the electoral system, or given the centrality of political parties to making elections work, to being the principal actors in electoral systems, this circular relationship that the electoral system will affect the parties, but the parties work the electoral system, is one that we have to pay attention to. And it's an important aspect of assessing electoral system. How many political parties do we want? What kinds of political parties do we want? What kinds of competition do we want to have? And again, you'll see if you look in that chapter by David, some arguments about that that flow to these kinds of systems. So, you know, looking at electoral systems, ask yourself, how does it influence the competitive relationship among them? What does it mean for the character of the legislature and the government? Should all political parties be allowed? Should we exclude some? Should we keep the nutters out, or should we get the nutters in? The Germans for 40 years didn't let communists get elected. They said, no, we're not having them. The Italians said, of course we are. This is a democracy. I mean, there are different responses and different electoral arrangements. Encourage some kind of groups, perhaps exclude other sorts. Well, I want to just take a few minutes, because we are starting to run out of time, to talk about voter choice and the impact of the electoral system from the perspective of voters. Because when we think about the electoral system, we can't think about just as how it affects government, just how it affects politics. We have to think about how it also affects citizens as participants, people who are involved. And we talked a little bit yesterday about the kind of choice that different systems give you. Because an important part of an electoral system is, I think, what the political scientists call the ballot structure. That means, what does it look like when you, what's a piece of paper or the computer terminal or whatever look like when you go in to vote? What are the kinds of choices you have? Some require you to simply select a preferred candidate or several candidates. You might get 3 X's or 1 X or 2 X. Sometimes you're asked simply to choose between political parties. Some electoral systems allow you to choose among the candidates of a party, saying, well, you've got to vote for this party, but you've got to choose which of the party's candidates you want. Sometimes you have to choose amongst parties and candidates, so you can kind of rank, well, I want first choices for this candidate of that party, but my second choice is for a different candidate of a different party, and you can kind of work your way through. Some systems allow you to weight your vote, so you can say, well, there's going to be a coalition, and it's going to have different strengths, and I like this party, and I like a little bit of that party, so maybe I'll give 3/4 of my vote to this party and 1/4 to that party or to a candidate. Because it's not an all or nothing game for me. I can see some merits in them both, but I don't kind of see equal merit, so I think that I can kind of weight it. Sometimes we just kind of rank them in kind of preference. Well, our system provides only the simplest kind of choice. Other systems provide considerably more, though those that do usually don't use single-member districts, although it could be possible. So how much choice do we want, and how will that affect what we do? I mean, if we have a system in which, you know, we're choosing amongst the candidates of a single party, that party is going to operate differently than when we don't have any choice amongst their candidates. They're going to decide them for us, and they're going to decide them probably on different criteria than us as voters. If we get to rank order them, that's going to have a different impact on what happens to the kind of political parties, how many there are, and how they will operate. So these things are connected up. How important an aspect is this? Moving along, identifiable representatives. Well, we talked a lot about this yesterday, and I think people talked about it in groups about how important it was for them to have a local representative. Elections allow us to choose someone who can represent us in a legislature. We can choose perhaps an individual, or we can perhaps choose a political party. Systems with local representatives, of course, tie politicians to voters in a way that isn't true when people are only voting for parties and not for individuals. We know that systems based on party representation don't have that kind of clear tie between voters and politicians. If there are several politicians in my area representing different parties, you know, I don't have the same kind of connection, and they can kind of pay as much or as little attention to me as they want because they know that there isn't that kind of direct link. So how important is it for us to have our own MLA? And is there a limit? I mean, after it gets so big, does it matter anymore? If we just divide the province into four squares and gave each square a representative, would that be good enough? Is there a kind of scale factor? One way to think about it is, think about relationships between, say, your MLA and your and voters and MPs and voters. MPs represent two and a half times as many voters as MLAs, sort of. Does that system work better or no differently? If it works no differently, that suggests we maybe don't need as many small electoral districts. If it doesn't work very well, maybe we need as many as we have. So what are the questions of scale and size, and how do they impact here? Because if we're going to have any kind of districting, and how many do we need, how big can they be? You know, if our districts were 500,000 people, would that be satisfactory? Kind of the size of, I think, an American congressional district. Or do we think that anything over about 15 or 20,000 people gets so big that, you know, we lose this kind of connection? So what's all that about? Do the systems encourage participation? One of the things that have been bothering people in democracies is that the number of people going to the polls has been falling steadily in most Western democracies for the last 10 or 15 years. It is one of the great puzzles of political science, or at least some political scientists, and why this is happening. Why it suddenly, around 1990, started to plunge. It's plunged probably more dramatically and farther in Canada than almost any other Western system. The real turnout rates in Canadian general elections are about the same as American presidential elections now. Not much more than about half the people who are of voting age are turning out at national general elections. And we know that in some provincial elections, turnout rates are even lower. Some of this has to do with the election lists, but some of it may have to do with the electoral systems. Do we have a system that is encouraging turnout? Do we have an electoral system that gives voters a reason to think that they might want to come to the polls? That they're going to have the kind of choices they need? That facilitates it? Is there any sure way? And the question is, or one question some people say is, well, but look at Australia. Everybody votes in Australia. It turns out there is a way to have almost everybody voting. Make a law. Almost everybody pays their taxes. Is that because we love to pay our taxes on April 30th? We really, really, really want to? No, it's because it's a law. Some people say, well, you know, an electoral system that essentially made it a law, it was another duty of citizenship. And I think there's a fine in Australia. Campbell knows the details of this. I don't know if he's ever been fined, but if you don't show up. But hardly anybody gets fined because almost everybody votes. It's just assumed that's kind of one of the things you need to do. And it's been built in as part of the electoral system. That may stretch our mandate a little bit. It may not be part of our mandate. But it's a simple answer, in fact. But if you really want to make a significant difference to turnout, you have to do something pretty dramatic and significant. The kinds of things we're likely to do with electoral systems are probably going to only have very modest kinds of effects. And lots of talks about it as too simple or too complicated. They may work on the margins, but they're not going to have profound kinds of effects. And finally, let me say something about the criteria of the equality of the vote. We've already considered this in terms of the system. You know, should votes in different areas count as much, and how can you arrange that? But there's also, we need to kind of consider it, I think, or you might want to consider it from the perspective of the individual voter. Are they treated equally? Does the system advantage some voters over others? We know that in, say, northern British Columbia, votes seem to count more because there are fewer people in constituencies. And maybe that's appropriate, and it's a way of making sure that the voices of different areas are heard from the point of view of the system. We might say, well, look, some inequalities are okay because we need to hear different regions, and that's the only realistic way we could do that. And so from the perspective of the wider system, that might seem to be a reasonable kind of conclusion to come to. From the perspective of the individual citizen, we might want to think about it differently. I mean, if I'm voting in North Vancouver, my brother's voting in the North Peace River, shouldn't our votes count the same, kind of as individual citizens? And so how can you kind of reconcile our interests as voters with the interests of the kind of the system? And is there a kind of maybe trade-off that needs to be made there? Under some electoral systems, that question would just simply disappear. Under pure proportional systems, all votes would count equally because there would be that kind of equal translation. So you don't have that kind of issue. So for some kinds of systems, this doesn't become the same kind of issue. And so the criteria isn't quite as relevant. And so how do systems deal with that problem of individual citizens' impacts being similar? Well, all this takes us, you know, we've gone through very quickly 9 sets of criteria, and I've thrown up a series of questions on the screen, 20 or 30 of them, that need to be asked and that you'll be asking. You'll be thinking as you're reading and thinking and debating about these kinds of questions. But ultimately, we're going to come down to a system in which we have to make some kind of trade-offs. And making an assessment of an electoral system will involve making some trade-offs amongst these different kind of criteria. And I was thinking last night, well, maybe we could think about the kind of trade-offs we have. If we think about our system now, we might think of it in this kind of way. We think of the things that it does well and the things that it does poorly and kind of plot them. We could say, well, our system is pretty good at providing for stable government, seems to provide for a fair amount of accountability, and seems to be very good at providing us with identifiable local MLAs. It doesn't do very well on parliamentary scrutiny. I can say that with no fear of contradiction because the Prime Minister is going around the country saying it. So we know it doesn't do very well in terms of fair representation, that there's no kind of connection between votes and seats. And it doesn't give us very much choice. So in terms of the amounts of choice, it does rather poorly. In terms of the other 3 criteria, we might say it's kind of middlemost in terms of producing democratic parties. It's kind of middlemost in terms of encouraging participation, though maybe sliding to the poor end. And a little closer to the poor end than not on the question of poor votes. So that's the kind of trade-offs we've made in producing the system we've got. A whole series of assessments have been made, mostly through kind of historical accent that's got us to where we are. But if we want to think about that, that's how we might kind of plot them. But let's say we decided that a couple of these things didn't matter to us. Let's say we said, well, this business of choice, maximum choice, we have enough choice. We go in, we decide who we want. Not a problem for us. We're not going to think that's a criteria of real importance. And this business of parliamentary scrutiny, this is just kind of a lot of politicians talk. What we need is a government that gets on with the job. We'll defeat them at the next election if we don't want them. And this is just kind of make work for politicians on committee. So we're not going to rate the parliamentary scrutiny criteria as all that important. But we did that, our trade-offs would suddenly look like this. We have a very different kind of picture of our system. Looks like it's much more weighted to the doing pretty well end of the sets of trade-offs. But let's say, no. We want choice. We think it's important that the politicians keep the government honest. So we've got to have choice and scrutiny back in there. But let's face it, this business of stable government, this is just talk. This is politicians wanting to extend their jobs. You know, if governments change, that's okay because they're kind of doing it under a different guise of shuffles and all that now anyway. And local MLAs, well, you know, that's the 19th century. You know, we don't need those anymore. We're now into the 21st century. So let's have a system that gives us some choice and some scrutiny, but let's not worry about stable government because that's kind of hokum, that's overblown. And the local MLA, well, that's kind of like our appendix. You know, they take them out and nobody notices, so we don't need them. So let's take those ones out, and what would the trade-offs look like? Well, suddenly it would look like this, our system. Very different kind of look, in terms of what the trade-offs might be. So this is why we need to think about these different criteria and which ones are important and what we're prepared to trade off. Because we're going to have to make kind of decisions about electoral systems in terms of all these different kinds of things. So which of these characteristics are more important to you? What kind of trade-offs? Are there other considerations you want to take into effect? Well, I hope that some of these questions will get you started the next hour with discussion groups. All of them we're going to answer in one way or another, either openly and explicitly or implicitly, when we are making decisions about individual electoral systems. Thank you. Here's the boss.
It's not true. Actually, you guys are the boss. I know that. Just some quick announcements. First of all, Campbell tells me that the internet access in AP Hall, this hall, is not a dynamic link. And I hope you understand what that means. The session which Ken covered today, a very fascinating session, the paper in your book is called Assessing Electoral Systems on the left-hand top of the page, and then weekend session session three. Apparently four or five people do not have that in their book, and we have extra copies at the help desk in the hallway, okay? So if you found you haven't got weekend one, session three, we have that for you. And the last thing is...
This will all go on the web, too.
Pardon me?
This will all go on the web, too.
And it will all be on the web page. Anyone who wishes this, by the way, will be on the web page. And then secondly, we want you to... get to your discussion groups no later than 10 to 11 and back in here for a wrap-up, questions with Ken and a wrap-up and a discussion what we're going to do next week by about 10 to 12. And just before you go, Susanna has an announcement too.
This announcement is from Joel, who is representing the consulting group that's running our surveys for us. And at the end of your discussion group session, there'll be a quick five-minute survey to get feedback from you. Sorry?
3 minutes.
A three-minute survey to get feedback from you about how this weekend went, specifically about the topics and the way the items were presented. So this is really a chance for you to say, you know, this worked for me, I need more of this, and we can shape the learning sessions to suit the needs of the group here. On the top of the evaluation survey is a code, and your code number is on the inside of your white handbook manual. If you don't have that with you, you can write your name on it. And the reason, the way that this is going to still remain anonymous is because when you finish writing out your surveys, they all go into a sealed envelope and they get passed over to Joel and the consulting firm. He is the only person that ever sees the surveys with the codes or the names on them. And the Citizens Assembly staff will only be receiving trends and statistics and summaries of the reports that you give us. So it's important that you write your code on there so Joel can track you down if you're overly unhappy or overly enthusiastic, and he can interact with you around those things. So that's just it around the survey, and you'll get a bit more instruction about it in your breakout session. Thank you.